not. I didn't see him. Mrs. Middleton showed him straight into the gun room and then came to tell my uncle.
And what did your uncle say?
He seemed rather annoyed, but went off at once. It was about 5 minutes later that I heard the sound of raised voices. I ran out into the hall and almost collided with Mrs. Middleton. Then we heard the shot. The gunroom door was locked on the inside, and we had to go right round the house to the window. Of course, that took some time, and the murderer had been able to get well away. My poor uncle, her voice faltered, had been shot through the head. I saw at once that he was dead. I sent Mrs. Middleton for the police. I was careful to touch nothing in the room, but to leave it exactly as I found it.
I nodded approval. Now, as to the weapon?
Well, I can make a guess at it, Captain Hastings. A pair of revolvers of my husband's were mounted upon the wall. One of them is missing. I pointed this out to the police, and they took the other one away with them. When they have extracted the bullet, I suppose they will know for certain.
May I go to the gunroom?
Oh, certainly. The police have finished with it, but the body has been removed.
She accompanied me to the scene of the crime. At that moment, Havering entered the hall, and with a quick apology, his wife ran to him. I was left to undertake my investigations alone. Now, I may as well confess at once that they were rather disappointing. In detective novels, clues abound. But here I could find nothing that struck me as out of the ordinary except a large bloodstain on the carpet where I judged the dead man had fallen. I examined everything with painstaking care and took a couple of pictures of the room with my little camera, which I had brought with me. I also examined the ground outside the window, but it appeared to have been so heavily trampled underfoot that I judged it was useless to waste time over it. No, I had seen all that Hunter's Lodge had to show me. I must go back to Elmsdale and get into touch with Jap. Accordingly, I took leave of the Haverings and was driven off in the car that had brought us from the station. I found Jap at the Matlock Arms, and he took me forthwith to see the body. Harrington Pace was a small, spare, clean-shaven man, typically American in appearance. He had been shot through the back of the head, and the revolver had been discharged at close quarters.
Turned away for a moment, remarked Jap, and the other fellow snatched up a revolver and shot him. The one Mrs. Havering handed over to us was fully loaded, and I suppose the other one was also. Curious what darn fool things people do. Fancy keeping two loaded revolvers hanging up on your wall.
What do you think of the case? I asked as we left the gruesome chamber behind us.
Well, I've got my eye on Havering to begin with. Oh, yes.
Noting my exclamation of astonishment,
Havering has one or two shady incidents in his past. When he was a boy at Oxford, there was some funny business about the signature on one of his father's cheques. All hushed up, of course. And then he's pretty heavily in debt now. And they're the kind of debts he wouldn't like to go to his uncle about. Whereas, you may be sure, the uncle's will would be in his favour. Oh, yes, I got my eye on him. And that's why I wanted to speak to him before he saw his wife. But their statements dovetail all right. And I've been to the station, and there's no doubt whatever that he left by the 6:15 that gets up to London at about 10:30. He went straight to his club, he says, and if that's confirmed all right, why? He couldn't have been shooting his uncle here at 9 o'clock in a black beard. Oh, yes, I was going to ask you what you thought about that beard.
Jap winked.
I thought it grew pretty fast. Grew in the 5 miles from Elmsdale to Hunter's Lodge. Now, Americans that I've met are mostly clean-shaven. Yes, it's amongst Mr. Pace's American associates that we'll have to look for the murderer. I questioned the housekeeper first, and then her mistress, and their stories agree all right, but I'm sorry Mrs. Havering didn't get a look at the fellow. Well, she's a smart woman, and she might have noticed something that would set us on the track.
I sat down and wrote a minute and lengthy account to Poirot. I was able to add various further items of information before I posted the letter. The bullet had been extracted and was proved to have been fired from a revolver identical with the one held by the police. Furthermore, Mr. Havering's movements on the night in question had been checked and verified, and it was proved beyond doubt that he had actually arrived in London by the train in question. And thirdly, a sensational development had occurred.
A city gentleman living at Ealing, on crossing Haven Green to get to the district railway station that morning, had observed a brown paper parcel stuck between the railings. Opening it, he found that it contained a revolver. He handed the parcel over to the local police station, and before night, it was proved to be the one we were in search of. The pair to that given us by Mrs. Havering. One bullet had been fired from it. All this I added to my report. A wire from Poirot arrived whilst I was at breakfast the following morning. Of course, black-bearded man was not Havering, only you or Jap would have such an idea. Wire me description of housekeeper and what clothes she wore this morning. Same of Mrs. Havering. Do not waste time taking photographs of interiors. They are underexposed and not in the least artistic. It seemed to me that Poirot's style was unnecessarily facetious. I also fancied he was a shade jealous of my position on the spot with full facilities for handling the case. His request for a description of the clothes worn by the two women appeared to me to be simply ridiculous, but I complied as well as I, a mere man, was able to. At 11, another wire came from Poirot. Advise Jap, arrest housekeeper before it is too late. Dumbfounded, I took the wire to Jap. He swore softly under his breath. He's the goods, Monsieur Poirot. Oh, if he says so, there's something in it. And I hardly noticed the woman. I don't know that I can go so far as arresting her, but I'll have her watched. We'll go up right away and take another look at her. But it was too late. Mrs. Middleton, that quiet, middle-aged woman who had appeared so normal and respectable, had vanished into thin air. Her box had been left behind. It contained only ordinary wearing apparel. There was no clue to her identity or as to her whereabouts. From Mrs. Havering, we elicited all the facts we could. I engaged her about 3 weeks ago when Mrs. Emery, our former housekeeper, left. She came to me from Mrs. Selborne's agency in Mount Street, a very well-known place. I get all my servants from there. They sent several women to see me, but this Mrs. Middleton seemed much the nicest and had splendid references. I engaged her on the spot and notified the agency of the fact. I can't believe that there was anything wrong with her. She was such a nice, quiet woman. The thing was certainly a mystery. Whilst it was clear that the woman herself could not have committed the crime, since at the moment the shot was fired, Mrs. Havering was with her in the hall, nevertheless, she must have some connection with the murder, or why should she suddenly take to her heels and bolt? I wired the latest development to Poirot and suggested returning to London and making inquiries at Selborne's agency. Poirot's reply was prompt. Useless to inquire at agency. They will never have heard of her. Find out what vehicle took her up to Hunter's Lodge when she first arrived there. Though mystified, I was obedient. The means of transport in Elmersdale were limited. The local garage had two battered Ford cars, and there were two station flies. None of these had been requisitioned on the date in question. Questioned, Mrs. Havering explained that she had given the woman the money for her fare down to Derbyshire and sufficient to hire a car or fly to take her up to Hunter's Lodge. There was usually one of the Fords at the station on the chance of its being required. And taking into consideration the further fact that nobody at the station had noticed the arrival of a stranger, black-bearded or otherwise, on the fatal evening, everything seemed to point to the conclusion that the murderer had come to the spot in a car, which had been waiting near at hand to aid his escape, and that the same car had brought the mysterious housekeeper to her new post. I may mention that inquiries at the agency in London bore out Poirot's prognostication. No such woman as Mrs. Middleton had ever been on their books. They had received the Honourable Mrs. Havering's application for a housekeeper and had sent her various applicants for the post. When she sent them the engagement fee, she omitted to mention which woman she had selected. Somewhat crestfallen, I returned to London. I found Poirot established in an armchair by the fire in a garish silk dressing gown. He greeted me with much affection.
Ah, mon ami Hastings, but how glad I am to see you. Veritably, I have for you a great affection. And you have enjoyed yourself, huh? You have run to and fro with a good Jap, huh? You have interrogated and investigated to your heart's content, huh?
Poirot, I cried, the thing's a dark mystery. It'll never be solved.
Oh, it is true that we are not likely to cover ourselves with glory over it.
Well, no, indeed, it's a hard nut to crack.
Oh, as far as that goes, I am very good at cracking the nuts. Oh, a veritable squirrel. It is not that which embarrasses me. I know well enough who killed Mr. Harrington Pace.
You know? Well, how did you find out?
Your illuminating answers to my wiles supplied me with the truth. See here, Hastings, let us examine the facts methodically and in order. Mr. Harrington Pace is a man with a considerable fortune, which at his death will doubtless pass to his nephew. Point number one. His nephew is known to be desperately hard up. Point number two. His nephew is also known to be, shall we say, a man of rather loose moral fibre. Point number three.
Yet, but Roger Havering is proved to have journeyed straight up to London.
Et précisément. And therefore, as Mr. Havering left Elmsdale at 6:15, and since Mr. Pace cannot have been killed before he left, or the doctor would have spotted the time of the crime as being given wrongly when he examined the body, we conclude quite rightly that Mr. Havering did not shoot his uncle. But there is a Mrs. Havering, Hastings.
What, impossible! The housekeeper was with her when the shot was fired.
Ah, yes, the housekeeper. But she has disappeared.
Well, she'll be found.
I think not. There is something peculiarly elusive about that housekeeper. Don't you think so, Hastings? It struck me at once.
Well, she played her part, I suppose, and then got out in the nick of time.
Ah, and what was her part?
Well, presumably to admit her confederate, the black-bearded man.
Oh, no. That was not her part. Her part was what you have just mentioned. To provide an alibi for Mrs. Havering at the moment the shot was fired. And no one will ever find her, mon ami, because she does not exist. There is no such person, as your so great Shakespeare says.
It was Dickens, I murmured, unable to suppress a smile.
But what do you mean, Poirot?
I mean that Zoe Havering was an actress before a marriage, that you and Jap only saw the housekeeper in a dark hall, a dim, middle-aged figure in black with a faint, subdued voice, eh? And finally, that neither you nor Jap, nor the local police whom the housekeeper fetched, ever saw Mrs. Middleton and her mistress at one and the same time. No, it was child's play for that clever and daring woman. On the pretext of summoning her mistress, she runs upstairs, slips on a bright jumper and a hat with black curls attached, which she jams down over the grey transformation. A few deft touches and the makeup is removed. A slight dusting of rouge. And the brilliant Zoe Havering comes down with her clear, ringing voice. Nobody looks particularly at the housekeeper. Why should they? There is nothing to connect her with the crime. She, too, has an alibi.
Yeah, but the revolver that was found at Ealing, Mrs. Havering couldn't have placed it there.
No, that was Roger Havering's job. But it was a mistake on their part. It put me on the right track. A man who has committed murder with a revolver, which he found on the spot, would fling it away at once. He would not carry it up to London with him. No, the motive was clear. The criminals wished to focus the interest of the police on a spot far removed from Derbyshire. They were anxious to get the police away as soon as possible from the vicinity of Hunter's Lodge. Of course, the revolver found at Ealing was not the one with which Mr. Pace was shot. Roger Havering discharged one shot from it, brought it up to London, went straight to his club to establish his alibi, then went quickly out to Ealing by the district, a matter of about 20 minutes only, placed the parcel where it was found, and so back to town. That charming creature, his wife, quietly shoots Mr. Pace after dinner. Huh? You remember, He was shot from behind? Another significant point, that. Reloads the revolver and puts it back in its place, and then starts off with a desperate little comedy.
But it's incredible, I muttered, fascinated. And yet...
And yet it is true. Bien sûr, my friend, it is true. But to bring that precious pair to justice, that is another matter. Well, Jap must do what he can. I have written him fully, but I fear very much as things that we shall be obliged to leave them to fate, or le bon Dieu, whichever you prefer. The wicked flourish like a green bay tree, I reminded him. But at a price, as things. Always at a price, croyez-vous.
Poirot's forebodings were confirmed. Jap, though convinced of the truth of his theory, was unable to get together the necessary evidence to ensure a conviction. Mr. Pace's huge fortune passed into the hands of his murderers. Nevertheless, Nemesis did overtake them. And when I read in the paper that the Honourable Roger and Mrs. Havering were amongst those killed in the crashing of the airmail to Paris, I knew that justice was satisfied. The $1 million bond robbery. What a number of bond robberies there have been lately, I observed one morning, laying aside the newspaper. Poirot, let's forsake the science of detection and take to crime instead.
You are on the, how do you say it, get-rich-quick tack, eh, mon ami?
Well, look at this last coup. The $1 million worth of Liberty Bonds, which the London and Scottish Bank were sending to New York, and which disappeared in such a remarkable manner on board the Olympia.
If it were not for the Malamère, I should delight to voyage myself on one of those big liners,
murmured Poirot dreamily.
Yes, indeed, I said enthusiastically. Some of them must be perfect palaces. The swimming bars, the lounges, the restaurants, the palm courts. Really, it must be hard to believe that one is on the sea.
Me, I always know when I am on the sea, said Poirot sadly. And all those bagatelles that you enumerate, they say nothing to me. But, my friend, consider for a moment the geniuses that travel, as it were, incognito. On board these floating palaces, as you so justly call them, one would meet the elite, the haute noblesse of the criminal world.
I laughed. So that's the way your enthusiasm runs. You would have liked to cross swords with the man who sneaked the Liberty Bonds? The landlady interrupted us.
A young lady wants to see you, Monsieur Poirot. Here's her card.
The card bore the inscription, Miss Esme Farquhar, and Poirot, after diving under the table to retrieve a stray crumb and putting it carefully in the wastepaper basket, nodded to the landlady to admit her. In another minute, one of the most charming girls I have ever seen was ushered into the room. She was perhaps about 25, with big brown eyes and a perfect figure. She was well-dressed and perfectly composed in manner.
Oh, sit down, I beg of you, mademoiselle. This is my friend, Captain Hastings, who aids me in my little problems.
Well, I'm afraid it is a big problem I have brought you today, Monsieur Poirot, said the girl, giving me a pleasant bow as she seated herself. I dare say you have read about it in the papers. I'm referring to the theft of Liberty Bonds on the Olympia.
Some astonishment must have shown itself on Poirot's face, for she continued quickly, "You are doubtless asking yourself, what have I to do with a grave institution like the London and Scottish Bank?
In one sense, nothing. In another sense, everything. You see, Monsieur Poirot, I am engaged to a Mr. Philip Ridgway."
And Mr. Philip Ridgway
was in charge of the bonds when they were stolen. Of course, no actual blame can attach to him. It wasn't his fault in any way. Nevertheless, he is half distraught over the matter, and his uncle, I know, insists that he must carelessly have mentioned having them in his possession. It is a terrible setback to his career.
Who is his uncle?
Mr. Vavasor, joint general manager of the London and Scottish Bank.
Now suppose, Miss Farquhar, that you recount to me the whole story.
Oh, very well. Now, as you know, the bank wished to extend their credits in America, and for this purpose decided to send over $1 million in Liberty Bonds. Mr. Vavasor selected his nephew, who had occupied a position of trust in the bank for many years, and who was conversant with all the details of the bank dealings in New York, to make the trip. The Olympia sailed from Liverpool on the 23rd, and the bonds were handed over to Philip on the morning of that day by Mr. Vavasor and Mr. Shaw, the two joint general managers of the London and Scottish Bank. They were counted, enclosed in a package, and sealed in his presence, and he then locked the package at once in his portmanteau.
A portmanteau with an ordinary lock?
No. Mr. Shaw insisted on a special lock being fitted to it by Hubbs. Philip, as I say, placed the package at the bottom of the trunk. It was stolen just a few hours before reaching New York. A rigorous search of the whole ship was made, but without result. The bonds seemed literally to have vanished into thin air.
Poirot made a grimace.
Oh, but they did not vanish absolutely, since I gather that they were sold in small parcels within half an hour of the docking of the Olympia. Well, undoubtedly the next thing is for me to see Mr. Ridgway.
Well, I was about to suggest that you should lunch with me at the Cheshire Cheese. Philip will be there. He's meeting me. But he does not yet know that I've been consulting you on his behalf.
We agreed to this suggestion readily enough and drove there in a taxi. Mr. Philip Ridgway was there before us and looked somewhat surprised to see his fiancée arriving with two complete strangers. He was a nice-looking young fellow, tall and spruce, with a touch of greying hair at the temples, though he couldn't have been much over 30. Miss Farquhar went up to him and laid her hand on his arm.
Oh, you must forgive me acting without consulting you, Philip. But let me introduce you to Monsieur Hercule Poirot, of whom you must often have heard, and his friend Captain Hastings.
Ridgway looked very astonished.
Oh, of course I've heard of you, Monsieur Poirot, he said, as he shook hands. But I had no idea that Esme was thinking of consulting you about my, well, our trouble. Well, I was afraid you wouldn't let me do it, Philip,
said Miss Farquhar meekly. So you took care to be on the safe side, he observed with a smile. I hope Monsieur Poirot will be able to throw some light on this extraordinary puzzle, for I confess frankly that I'm nearly out of my mind with worry and anxiety about it. Indeed, his face looked drawn and haggard, and showed only too clearly the strain under which he was labouring.
Well, well, said Poirot, let us lunch, and over lunch we will put our heads together and see what can be done. I want to hear Mr. Ridgway's story from his own lips.
Whilst we discussed the excellent steak and kidney pudding of the establishment, Philip Ridgway narrated the circumstances leading to the disappearance of the bonds. His story agreed with that of Miss Farquhar in every particular. When he had finished, Poirot took up the thread with a question.
And what exactly led you to discover that the bonds had been stolen, Mr. Ridgway?
He laughed rather bitterly.
Oh, the thing stared me in the face, Monsieur Poirot. I couldn't have missed it.
My cabin trunk was pulled half out from under the bunk, and it was all scratched and cut about, where they had tried to force the lock.
Oh, but I understood that it had been opened with a key.
Well, yes, that's so. They tried to force it, but couldn't. And in the end, they must have got it unlocked somehow or other.
Curious, said Poirot,
his eyes beginning to flicker with the green light I knew so well.
Very curious. They waste much time trying to pry it open, and then, sapristi, they find they have the key all the time. For each of Hub's logs are unique.
Well, that's just why they couldn't have had the key. It never left me day or night.
You are sure of that?
Oh, I can swear to it. And besides, if they had had the key, or a duplicate, why should they waste time trying to force an obviously unforceable lock?
There is exactly the question we are asking ourselves. I venture to prophesy that the solution, if we ever find it, will hinge on that curious fact. I beg of you not to assault me. If I ask you one more question, are you perfectly certain that you did not leave the trunk unlocked?
Philip Ridgway merely looked at him, and Poirot gesticulated apologetically.
No, but these things can happen, I assure you. Very well, the bonds were stolen from the trunk. Oh, what did the thief do with them? How did he manage to get ashore with them?
Ah, cried Ridgway. But that's just it. How? Well, word was passed to the customs authorities, and every soul that left the ship was gone over with a tooth comb.
And the bonds, I gather, made a bulky package?
Well, certainly they did. They could hardly have been hidden on board, and anyway, we know they weren't, because they were offered for sale within half an hour of the Olympia's arrival, long before I got the cables going and the numbers sent out. One broker swears he bought some of them even before the Olympia got in. But you can't send bonds by wireless.
No, not by wireless, but did any tug come alongside?
Well, only the official ones, and that was after the alarm was given when everyone was on the lookout. I was watching out myself for their being passed over to someone that way. My God, Monsieur Poirot, this thing will drive me mad. People are beginning to say I stole them myself.
Yeah, but you also were searched on landing, weren't you?
Asked Poirot gently.
Yes.
The young man stared at him in a puzzled manner.
You do not catch my meaning, I see,
said Poirot, smiling enigmatically.
Now, I should like to make a few inquiries at the bank.
Ridgway produced a card and scribbled a few words on it. Send this in, and my uncle will see you at once. Poirot thanked him, bade farewell to Miss Farquhar, and together we started out for Threadneedle Street in the head office of the London and Scottish Bank. On production of Ridgway's card, we were led through the labyrinth of counters and desks, skirting, paying in clerks and paying out clerks, and up to a small office on the first floor where the joint general managers received us. They were two grave gentlemen who had grown grey in the service of the bank. Mr. Vavasor had a short white beard. Mr. Shaw was clean-shaven.
I understand that you are strictly a private inquiry agent, said Mr. Vavasor.
Oh, quite so, quite so. We have, of course, placed ourselves in the hands of Scotland Yard. Inspector McNeil has charge of the case, a very able officer, I believe.
I am sure of it, said Poirot politely. You will permit a few questions on your nephew's behalf. About this lock, who ordered it from Hubbs?
I ordered it myself, said Mr. Shaw. I would not trust to any clerk in the matter. As to the keys, Mr. Ridgway had one, and the other two are held by my colleague and myself.
And no clerk has had access to them?
Mr. Shaw turned inquiringly to Mr. Vavasor.
I think I'm correct in saying that they have remained in the safe where we placed them on the 23rd,
said Mr. Vavasor.
My colleague was unfortunately taken ill a fortnight ago. In fact, on the very day that Philip left us. He's only just recovered.
Well, severe bronchitis is no joke to a man of my age,
said Mr. Shaw ruefully.
But I'm afraid Mr. Vavasor has suffered from the hard work entailed by my absence, especially with this unexpected worry coming on top of everything.
Poirot asked a few more questions. I judged that he was endeavouring to gauge the exact amount of intimacy between uncle and nephew. Mr. Vavasor's answers were brief and punctilious. His nephew was a trusted official of the bank and had no debts or money difficulties that he knew of. He had been entrusted with similar missions in the past, and finally we were politely bowed out.
I am disappointed,
said Poirot as we emerged into the street. Well, you hope to discover more? They're such stodgy old men.
No, it is not their stodginess which disappoints me, mon ami. I do not expect to find in a bank manager a keen financier with an eagle glance, as your favourite works of fiction put it. No, I am disappointed in the case. It is too easy.
Easy?
Yes. Do you not find it almost childishly simple?
Well, you know who stole the bonds.
I do.
But then we must... Why...
Do not confuse and fluster yourself, Hastings. We are not going to do anything at present.
But why? What are you waiting for?
For the Olympia. She is due on her return trip from New York on Tuesday.
But if you know who stole the bonds, why wait? He may escape.
To a South Sea island where there is no extradition? No, mon ami. He would find life very uncongenial there. As to why I wait? Eh bien, To the intelligence of Hercule Poirot, the case is perfectly clear, but for the benefit of others, not so greatly gifted by the good God. The Inspector McNeil, for instance. It would be as well to make a few inquiries to establish the facts. One must have consideration for those less gifted than oneself.
Good Lord, Poirot! Do you know, I'd give a considerable sum of money to see you make a thorough ass of yourself, just for once. You're so confoundedly conceited.
Do not enrage yourself as things. In verity, I observe that there are times when you almost detest me. Alas, I suffer the penalties of greatness.
The little man puffed out his chest and sighed so comically that I was forced to laugh. Tuesday saw us speeding to Liverpool in a first-class railway carriage. Poirot had obstinately refused to enlighten me as to his suspicions or certainties. He contented himself with expressing surprise that I, too, was not equally au fait with the situation. I disdained to argue and entrenched my curiosity behind a rampart of pretended indifference. Once arrived at the quay, alongside which lay the big transatlantic liner, Poirot became brisk and alert. Our proceedings consisted in interviewing four successive stewards and inquiring after a friend of Poirot's who had crossed to New York on the 23rd.
An elderly gentleman wearing glasses, eh? A great invalid, hardly moved out of his cabin.
The description appeared to tally with one Mr. Ventnor, who had occupied the cabin C-24, which was next to that of Philip Ridgway. Although unable to see how Poirot had deduced Mr. Ventnor's existence and personal appearance, I was keenly excited. "Tell me," I cried, "was this gentleman one of the first to land when you got to New York?" The steward shook his head.
"No, indeed, sir. He was one of the last off the boat."
I retired crestfallen and observed Poirot grinning at me. He thanked the steward, a note changed hands, and we took our departure.
"Well, it's all very well," I remarked heatedly, "but that last answer must have damned your precious theory. Grin as you please."
"Ah, as usual, you see nothing as things. That last answer is, on the contrary, the coping stone of my theory."
I flung up my hands in despair.
"I give up!"
When we were in the train, speeding towards London, Poirot wrote busily for a few minutes, sealing up the result in an envelope.
"Ah, this is for the good Inspector McNeil. We will leave it at Scotland Yard in passing, and then to the Rendezvous restaurant, where I have asked Miss Esme Farquhar to do us the honour of dining with us."
"Well, what about Ridgway?"
"Oh, what about him?"
asked Poirot with a twinkle.
"Why, you surely don't think... you can't..."
The habit of incoherence is growing upon you, Hastings. As a matter of fact, I did think, if Ridgway had been the thief, which was perfectly possible, the case would have been charming, a piece of neat, methodical work."
"Yes, but not so charming for Miss Farquhar."
"Oh, possibly you are right. Therefore, all is for the best. Now, Hastings, let us review the case. I can see that you are dying to do so, huh? Now, the sealed package is removed from the trunk and vanishes, as Miss Farquhar puts it, poof, into thin air. Now, we will dismiss the thin air theory, which is not practical at the present stage of science, and consider what is likely to have become of it. Everyone asserts the incredulity of its being smuggled ashore. Yes, but we know..." "You may know, Hastings. I do not. I take the view that, since it seemed incredible, it was incredible. Two possibilities remain. It was hidden on board, also rather difficult, or it was thrown overboard."
"But with a cork on it, you mean?"
"Without a cork."
I stared.
"But if the bonds were thrown overboard, they couldn't have been sold in New York."
"I admire your logical mind, Hastings. The bonds were sold in New York, therefore they were not thrown overboard. You see where that leads us?"
"Well, where we were when we started."
"Jamais de la vie. If the package was thrown overboard and the bonds were sold in New York, the package could not have contained the bonds. Is there any evidence that the package did contain the bonds? Remember, Mr. Ridgway never opened it from the time it was placed in his hands in London.
Yes, but then...
Poirot waved an impatient hand.
Permit me to continue. The last moment that the bonds are seen as bonds is in the office of the London and Scottish Bank on the morning of the 23rd. They reappear in New York half an hour after the Olympia gets in, and according to one man, whom nobody listens to, actually before she gets in. Now, supposing then that they have never been on the Olympia at all. Is there any other way they could get to New York? Yes. The Gigantic leaves Southampton on the same day as the Olympia, and she holds the record for the Atlantic. Mailed by the Gigantic, the bonds would be in New York the day before the Olympia arrived. All is clear. The case begins to explain itself. The sealed packet is only a dummy, and the moment of its substitution must be in the office in the bank. It would be an easy matter for any of the three men present to have prepared a duplicate package which could be substituted for the genuine one. Très bien. The bonds are mailed to a confederate in New York with instructions to sell as soon as the Olympia is in. But someone must travel on the Olympia to engineer the supposed moment of robbery.
But why?
Because if Ridgway merely opens the packet and finds it a dummy, suspicion flies at once to London. No. The man on board in the cabin next door does his work, pretends to force the lock in an obvious manner so as to draw immediate attention to the theft, really unlocks the trunk with a duplicate key, throws the package overboard, and waits until the last to leave the boat. Naturally, he wears glasses to conceal his eyes, and is an invalid since he does not want to run the risk of meeting Ridgway. He steps ashore in New York and returns by the first boat available.
But who? Which was he?
The man who had a duplicate key? The man who ordered the lock? The man who has not been severely ill with bronchitis at his home in the country? Enfin, the stodgy old man, Mr. Shaw. There are criminals in high places sometimes, my friend. Ah, here we are. Mademoiselle, I have succeeded. You permit?
And beaming, Poirot kissed the astonished girl lightly on either cheek. The Adventure of the Egyptian Tomb. I have always considered that one of the most thrilling and dramatic of the many adventures I've shared with Poirot was that of our investigation into the strange series of deaths which followed upon the discovery and opening of the tomb of King Menerah. Hard upon the discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun by Lord Carnarvon, Sir John Willard and Mr. Bleibner of New York, pursuing their excavations not far from Cairo, in the vicinity of the pyramids of Gizeh, came unexpectedly on a series of funeral chambers. The greatest interest was aroused by their discovery. The tomb appeared to be that of King Menerah, one of those shadowy kings of the 8th dynasty, when the old kingdom was falling to decay. Little was known about this period, and the discoveries were fully reported in the newspapers. An event soon occurred which took a profound hold on the public mind. Sir John Willard died, quite suddenly, of heart failure. The more sensational newspapers immediately took the opportunity of reviving all the old superstitious stories connected with the ill luck of certain Egyptian treasures. The unlucky mummy at the British Museum, that hoary old chestnut, was dragged out with fresh zest, was quietly denied by the museum, but nevertheless enjoyed all its usual vogue. A fortnight later, Mr. Bleibner died of acute blood poisoning, and a few days afterwards a nephew of his shot himself in New York. The curse of Menerah was the talk of the day, and the magic power of dead and gone Egypt was exalted to a fetish point. It was then that Poirot received a brief note from Lady Willard, widow of the dead archaeologist, asking him to go and see her at her house in Kensington Square. I accompanied him. Lady Willard was a tall, thin woman, dressed in deep mourning. Her haggard face bore eloquent testimony to her recent grief.
"It is kind of you to have come so promptly, Monsieur Poirot."
"Oh, I am at your service, Lady Willard. You wished to consult me, eh?"
"You are, I am aware, a detective. But it's not only as a detective that I wish to consult you. You're a man of original views, I know. You have imagination, experience of the world. Tell me, Monsieur Poirot, what are your views on the supernatural?"
Poirot hesitated for a moment before he replied. He seemed to be considering. Finally, he said,
"Well, let us not misunderstand each other, Lady Willard. It is not a general question that you are asking me here. It has a personal application, has it not? You are referring obliquely to the death of your late husband."
"That is so," she admitted.
"And you want me to investigate the circumstances of his death?"
"I want you to ascertain for me exactly how much is newspaper chatter and how much may be said to be founded on fact. 3 deaths, Monsieur Poirot. Each one explicable, taken by itself. But taken together, surely an almost unbelievable coincidence, and all within a month of the opening of the tomb. It may be mere superstition. It may be some potent curse from the past that operates in ways undreamed of by modern science. The fact remains, 3 deaths, and I am afraid, Monsieur Poirot, horribly afraid. It may not yet be the end."
"For whom do you fear?"
"For my son. When the news of my husband's death came, I was ill. My son, who has just come down from Oxford, went out there. He brought the body home. But now he's gone out again, in spite of my prayers and entreaties. He's so fascinated by the work that he intends to take his father's place and carry on the system of excavation. Now, you may think me a foolish, credulous woman, but, Monsieur Poirot, I am afraid. Supposing that the spirit of the dead king is not yet appeased, perhaps to you I seem to be talking nonsense, but—"
"No, indeed, Lady Willard," said Poirot quickly. "I, too, believe in the force of superstition, one of the greatest forces the world has ever known."
I looked at him in surprise. I should never have credited Poirot with being superstitious. But the little man was obviously in earnest.
"What you really demand is that I shall protect your son? I will do my utmost to keep him from harm."
"Yes, in the ordinary way, but against an occult influence?"
"In volumes of the Middle Ages, Lady Willard, you will find many ways of counteracting black magic. Perhaps they knew more than we moderns, with all our boasted science. Now, let us come to facts, so that I may have guidance. Your husband had always been a devoted Egyptologist, hadn't he?"
"Yes, from his youth upwards. He was one of the greatest living authorities upon the subject."
"But Mr. Blattner, I understand, was more or less of an amateur?"
"Oh, quite. He was a very wealthy man who dabbled freely in any subject that happened to take his fancy. My husband managed to interest him in Egyptology, and it was his money that was so useful in financing the expedition."
"And the nephew? What do you know of his tastes? Was he with the party at all?"
"I don't think so. In fact, I never knew of his existence till I read of his death in the paper. I don't think he and Mr. Bleibner can have been at all intimate. Well, he never spoke of having any relations."
"Who are the other members of the party?"
"Well, there's Dr. Toswell, a minor official connected with the British Museum, Mr. Snyder of the Metropolitan Museum in New York, a young American secretary, Dr. Ames, who accompanies the expedition in his professional capacity, and Hassan, my husband's devoted native servant."
"Do you remember the name of the American secretary?"
"Harper, I think, but I cannot be sure. He had not been with Mr. Bleibner very long, I know. He was a very pleasant young fellow."
"Thank you, Lady Willard."
"If there's anything else, I—"
"For the moment, nothing. Leave it now in my hands, and be assured that I will do all that is humanly possible to protect your son."
They were not exactly reassuring words, and I observed Lady Willard wince as he uttered them. Yet, at the same time, the fact that he had not pooh-poohed her fears seemed in itself to be a relief to her. Now, for my part, I had never before suspected that Poirot had so deep a vein of superstition in his nature. I tackled him on the subject as we went homewards. His manner was grave and earnest.
"But yes, such things. I believe in these things. You must not underrate the force of superstition."
"Well, what are we going to do about it?"
"Toujours pratique, the goodest things. Eh bien, to begin with, we are going to cable New York for fuller details of young Mr. Bladner's death."
He duly sent off his cable. The reply was full and precise. Young Rupert Bladner had been in low water for several years. He had been a beachcomber and a remittance man in several South Sea islands, but had returned to New York 2 years ago, where he had rapidly sunk lower and lower. Well, the most significant thing, to my mind, was that he'd recently managed to borrow enough money to take him to Egypt. "I have a good friend there I can borrow from," he had declared. Here, however, his plans had gone awry. He had returned to New York cursing his skinflint of an uncle, who cared more for the bones of dead and gone kings than his own flesh and blood. Now, it was during his sojourn in Egypt that the death of Sir John Willard had occurred. Rupert had plunged once more into his life of dissipation in New York, and then, without warning, he had committed suicide, leaving behind him a letter which contained some curious phrases. It seemed written in a sudden fit of remorse. He referred to himself as a leper and an outcast, and the letter ended by declaring that such as he were better dead. A shadowy theory leapt into my brain. I'd never really believed in the vengeance of a long-dead Egyptian king, but I saw here a more modern crime. Supposing this young man had decided to do away with his uncle, preferably by poison. By mistake, Sir John Willard receives the fatal dose. The young man returns to New York, haunted by his crime. The news of his uncle's death reaches him. He realizes how unnecessary his crime has been, and, stricken with remorse, takes his own life. I outlined my solution to Poirot. He was interested.
"It is ingenious what you have thought of there. Decidedly, it is ingenious. It may even be true. But you count not the fatal influence of the tomb."
I shrugged my shoulders. "You still think that has something to do with it?"
"So much so, mon ami, that we start for Egypt tomorrow."
"What?" I cried, astonished.
"I have said it."
An expression of conscious heroism spread over Poirot's face. Then he groaned,
"But, oh, the sea, oh, the hateful sea."
It was a week later. Beneath our feet was the golden sand of the desert. The hot sun poured down overhead. Poirot, the picture of misery, wilted by my side. The little man was not a good traveller. Our 4 days' voyage from Marseille had been one long agony to him. He'd landed at Alexandria, the wraith of his former self. Even his usual neatness had deserted him. We had arrived in Cairo and had driven out at once to the Mena House Hotel, right in the shadow of the pyramids. The charm of Egypt had laid hold of me. Not so Poirot. Dressed precisely the same as in London, he carried a small clothes brush in his pocket and waged an unceasing war on the dust which accumulated on his dark apparel.
"And my boots!" he wailed. "Regard them, Hastings, my boots of the neat patent leather, usually so smart and shining. See, the sand is inside them, which is painful, and outside them, which outrages the sight. Also the heat, it causes my moustaches to become limp, but limp."
"But look at the Sphinx," I urged. "Even I can feel the mystery and the charm it exhales." Poirot looked at it, discontentedly.
"No, it is not the air happy," he declared. "How could it, half buried in the sand, in that untidy fashion? Ah, oh, the discursed sand!"
"Oh, come now, there's a lot of sand in Belgium," I reminded him, mindful of a holiday spent at Nox-sur-Mer in the midst of les dunes impeccables, as the guidebook had phrased it.
Not in Brussels, declared Poirot.
He gazed at the pyramids thoughtfully.
It is true that they at least are of shape solid and geometrical, but their surface is of an unevenness most unpleasing. And the palm trees, I like them not. Not even do they plant them in rows.
I cut short his lamentations by suggesting that we should start for the camp. We were to ride there on camels, and the beasts were patiently kneeling, waiting for us to mount, in charge of several picturesque boys headed by a voluble dragoman. I pass over the spectacle of Poirot on a camel. He started by groans and lamentations, and ended by shrieks, gesticulations, and invocations to the Virgin Mary and every saint in the calendar. In the end, he descended ignominiously and finished the journey on a diminutive donkey. I must admit that a trotting camel is no joke for the amateur. I was stiff for several days. At last we neared the scene of the excavations. A sunburnt man with a grey beard in white clothes and wearing a helmet came to meet us.
Monsieur Poirot and Captain Hastings, we received your cable. I'm sorry that there was no one to meet you in Cairo. An unforeseen event occurred which completely disorganized our plans.
Poirot paled. His hand, which had stolen to his clothes brush, stayed its course.
Not another death, he breathed.
Yes.
Sir Guy Willard, I cried.
No, Captain Hastings, my American colleague, Mr. Schneider.
And the cause? Demanded Poirot.
Tetanus.
I blanched. All around me I seemed to feel an atmosphere of evil, subtle and menacing. A horrible thought flashed across me. Supposing I were next?
Mon Dieu, said Poirot in a very low voice. I do not understand this. It is horrible. Tell me, monsieur, there is no doubt that it was tetanus, eh?
Well, I believe not, but Dr. Ames will tell you more than I can do.
Ah, of course, you are not a doctor.
No, my name is Toswell.
This, then, was the British expert described by Lady Willard as being a minor official at the British Museum. There was something at once grave and steadfast about him that took my fancy.
If you'll come with me, continued Dr. Toswell, I will take you to Sir Guy Willard. He was most anxious to be informed as soon as you should arrive.
We were taken across the camp to a large tent. Dr. Toswell lifted up the flap, and we entered. Three men were sitting inside.
Monsieur Poirot and Captain Hastings have arrived, Sir Guy, said Toswell.
The youngest of the three jumped up and came forward to greet us. There was a certain impulsiveness in his manner which reminded me of his mother. He was not nearly so sunburnt as the others, and that fact, coupled with a certain haggardness round the eyes, made him look older than his 22 years. He was clearly endeavouring to bear up under a severe mental strain. He introduced his two companions, Dr. Ames, a capable-looking man of 30-odd, with a touch of greying hair at the temples, and Mr. Harper, the secretary, a pleasant, lean young man wearing the national insignia of horn-rimmed spectacles. After a few minutes' desultory conversation, the latter went out and Dr. Toswell followed him. We were left alone with Sir Guy and Dr. Ames.
"Please ask any questions you want to ask, Monsieur Poirot," said Willard. "We're utterly dumbfounded at this strange series of disasters, but it isn't— well, it can't be anything but coincidence."
There was a nervousness about his manner which rather belied the words. I saw that Poirot was studying him keenly.
"Your heart is really in this work, Sergei?"
"Oh, rather! No matter what happens or what comes of it, the work is going on. Now make up your mind to that."
Poirot wheeled round on the other.
"And what have you to say to that, Monsieur le Docteur?"
"Well," drawled the doctor, "I'm not for quitting myself."
"Then, évidemment, we must find out just how we stand. When did Mr. Schneider's death take place?"
3 days ago."
"Now you're sure it was tetanus?"
"Dead sure."
"It couldn't have been a case of strychnine poisoning, for instance?"
"Oh, no, Monsieur Poirot. Now, I see what you're getting at, but no, it was a clear case of tetanus."
Did you not inject anti-serum?"
"Oh, certainly we did," said the doctor dryly. "Every conceivable thing that could be done was tried."
"Had you the anti-serum with you?"
"No, we procured it
from Cairo. Have there been any other cases of tetanus in the camp? No, not one. Now you are certain that the death of Mr. Bleibner was not due to tetanus?
Absolutely plumb certain. He had a scratch upon his thumb which became poisoned and septicemia set in. Now it sounds pretty much the same to a layman, I dare say, but the two things are entirely different.
Oh, then we have four deaths, all totally dissimilar. One heart failure, one blood poisoning, one suicide, and one tetanus.
Exactly, Monsieur Poirot.
Are you certain that there is nothing which might link the four together?
Well, I don't quite understand you.
Well, let me put it plainly. Was any act committed by those four men which might seem to denote disrespect to the spirit of Menera?
The doctor gazed at Poirot in astonishment.
You're talking through your hat, Monsieur Poirot. Surely you've not been guided into believing all that fool talk?
It is absolute nonsense, muttered Willard angrily.
Poirot remained placidly immovable, blinking a little out of his green cat's eyes.
So, you do not believe it, Monsieur le Docteur?
No, sir, I do not, declared the doctor emphatically. I'm a scientific man, and I believe only what science teaches.
Was there no science then in ancient Egypt?
Asked Poirot softly. He did not wait for a reply, and indeed Dr. Ames seemed rather at a loss for the moment.
Oh, no, do not answer me. But tell me this, what do the native workmen think, huh?
Well, I guess, said Dr. Ames, that where white folk lose their heads, natives aren't going to be far behind. I'll admit that they're getting what you might call scared, but they've no cause to be.
I wonder,
said Poirot non-committally. Sir Guy leant forward.
Surely, he cried incredulously, you can't believe in... Oh, but the thing's absurd. You can know nothing of ancient Egypt if you think that.
For answer, Poirot produced a little book from his pocket, an ancient, tattered volume. As he held it out, I saw its title, The Magic of the Egyptians and Chaldeans. Then, wheeling round, he strode out of the tent. The doctor stared at me.
What is his little idea?
The phrase, so familiar on Poirot's lips, made me smile as it came from another.
I don't know exactly, I confessed.
He's got some plan of exorcising the evil spirits, I believe. I went in search of Poirot and found him talking to the lean-faced young man who had been the late Mr. Bleibner's secretary. No, Mr. Harper was saying. I've only been 6 months with the expedition.
Yes, I knew Mr. Bleibner's affairs pretty well.
And can you recount to me anything concerning his nephew?
Well, he turned up here one day, not a bad-looking fellow. I'd never met him before, but some of the others had. Ames, I think, and Schneider. The old man wasn't at all pleased to see him. They were at it in no time, hammer and tongs. Not a cent, the old man shouted. Not 1 cent now or when I'm dead. I intend to leave my money to the furtherance of my life's work. I've been talking it over with Mr. Schneider today. And, you know, well, a bit more of the same. Young Bleibner lit out for Cairo right away.
And was he in perfectly good health at the time?
What, the old man?
No, the young one.
Well, I believe he did mention there was something wrong with him, but it couldn't have been anything serious, or I should have remembered.
Oh, now, one thing more. Has Mr. Bleibner left a will?
So far as we know, he has not.
Are you remaining with the expedition, Mr. Harper?
No, sir, I'm not. I'm for New York as soon as I can square up things here. Now, you may laugh if you like, but I'm not going to be this blasted Menera's next victim. He'll get me if I stop here.
The young man wiped the perspiration from his brow. Poirot turned away. Over his shoulder, he said with a peculiar smile,
Remember, he got one of his victims in New York.
Oh, hell,
said Mr. Harper forcibly.